Hello, and welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. The topic for today is great books. In this episode, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Jeff Frederick, is joined by faculty from the Department of English, Theater, and Foreign Languages. With him are Melissa Schaub, Abigail Mann, Autumn Lawson, and Charles Tita. Get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
Publishing is a $120 billion per year global business, and a complicated one at that. As many as 1 million different books are published in a good year, yet the average book sells less than 250 copies per year and less than 3,000 over the lifespan of the work. Americans read digital and print books that they buy or borrow from the library or from their friends, or by negotiating that paperback at the garage sale or church bazaar from a quarter all the way down to a dime. In fact, about 72% of Americans read at least one book per year. On average, Americans read 12 books, that's the statistical mean, per year. But that number is artificially inflated by, say, Bill Gates, who reads 50 a year, or faculty members at UNC Pembroke, who sometimes read even more than that. And certainly grad students in the humanities or social sciences who might read scholarly books by the dozens in a calendar year. In fact, the typical American reads 4 books. That's the statistical mode per year. Americans buy Bibles and Harry Potter books, Diary of a Wimpy Kid readers, political screeds from one extreme to the other, diet books, self-help how-tos, novels for the beach or the mountains, mysteries, textbooks, biographies, the occasional pop history, cookbooks, Dr. Seuss, and every once in a while, a few of the all-time classics. And about this time of year, Americans seem a bit more likely to buy one of the great books, as lists proliferate each January, encourage folks to read the classics. More than a few Americans will make New Year's resolutions to exercise more, lose a couple of pounds, get more organized, and read some of the great books. It may come as no surprise that long before Valentine's Day, these resolutions fall by the wayside. And the failure to keep the reading resolution might be more critical than some would think. Not surprisingly, in an information-critical economy, those with low literacy tend to be making less amounts of money, and they have disproportionate health issues. Not to put too fine a point on this, but prison populations tend to include high percentages of people who did not finish high school and have low literacy rates. According to the Harvard School of Public Health, watching television for more than 2 hours each day, instead of, say, reading, is linked to a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Something about having that television on creates an overwhelming desire for a heaping bowl of ice cream, or the need to grab a bag of chips, or, given this time of year, a box or two of Girl Scout cookies. More than 3 hours of television consumption daily may lead to a greater risk of premature death. From the perspective of the glass of water that's half full, readers sleep better, readers have higher intelligence, and by at least one study, readers are more empathetic, have less stress, and stronger imaginations. So if you're going to read, and in fact it's good for you, why not read something great? Allowing for taste and genre, author style and period, there are still unequivocally great books that capture the reader. Toss them into a world of conflict, love, or predicament, and resonate in their heads for days as each of us wrestle and re-wrestle with one plot twist or another. Great books are worth reading and rereading because of a million reasons that readers inherently understand and non-readers don't ever seem to grasp. Readers might still like the movie, but nothing actually beats the book. And the word pictures and mental images that fill your head and cause you to sit in an uncomfortable position for far too long simply because you cannot put down the book. Our topic for today, great books. And joining us are four excellent scholars of literature who are here to help us talk about what makes a book great, why and how we ought to read them, and some of the great books that we ought to be spending time with. Welcome, Abby and Autumn. Charles and Melissa. What was the first great book you remember reading that you literally couldn't put down, and what was it about that book that hooked you? Charles?
I was 12 years old when I first read Mark Twain's The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. There was something about this novel that gripped and held my attention as a reader. I did not know why, And that was because I did not yet have the foreknowledge of literary theory to analyze my relation to that text. It was amazing that an American novel set in a town along the Mississippi River in Missouri would stir the imagination of a 12-year-old halfway around the world in Cameroon. Mm-hmm. That kind of reader response is an important characteristic of a great book, I think. Great books, even in their abridged versions, have such an impact on readers. In my case, I believe, Tom Sawyer reinforced in me the awe and wonder of the regional folktales that my grandmother told me. Like in those folktales, the adventures of Tom Sawyer is replete with the mysteries of the river, the graveyard, and so forth. It is full of local color and ordinary people. I was also intrigued by Tom's relationships with people and with his environment. I noticed how he tricks his friends to do his chores, as in whitewashing the fence his aunt had assigned him.
So, something you never did, by the way, trick your friends into doing those chores.
Something I did all the time, right? So that is how I remember reading my first grade book.
What about the rest of y'all?
I don't think any of us want to answer after such a good answer from Charles. I actually started thinking the other way. I mean, one answer is I was a dork and I don't remember ever not being completely engrossed in books. Like, I spent, like, long parts of my childhood pretending to be Laura Ingalls Wilder's from the
yes,
Little House books.
Yes.
And please do not look up my second and third grade class photos in which I am wearing Laura Ingalls Wilder's dresses. But I did want to say that I remember not being engrossed by books that I love now, that my father would be like, you have to read something good, and force me to read it. And I remember hating Jane Eyre, and I remember hating David Copperfield, which I love now. So one of the things I want to say is I think sometimes why you love a book is when you read it in your life, and that if there's a book that you remember being forced to read by your father or by school or something that didn't work, because now I do remember just multiple times reading Jane Eyre, reading David Copperfield, and not being able to put it down. So there are times in our life when we are ready for books, and there's times when we're not. And
well, I'm going to add to that and say I also am the kind of, I'm going to say nerd, who, I can't answer your question truthfully because I don't know what the first book was. I know the one that first popped into my mind was a tie between two different fantasy novels that feature middle school-aged girls, which is what I was when I read them, one by Anne McCaffrey, one by Mercedes Lackey. Mm. These were fantasy worlds, but the character was exactly like me, or at least I thought the character was exactly like me, went through problems that I thought I had, and yes, even though I do not have a dragon or a telepathic horse, the characters went through the same kinds of problems I thought that I had. And that is certainly one way, or a very common way, that people respond to books. You identify with the main character and you enjoy being immersed in that character's world because you think you're going to get something sort of directly for yourself out of it. But I don't know that I was thinking about it that way while I was reading, even though I did fantasize the dragon coming for me. I did. But I was also an avid reader of nonfiction, and I think that's something that gets neglected a lot when we talk about great books. I've heard a number of my son's teachers say that they think boys are more likely to be captured by nonfiction. And I know that I loved books about ancient civilizations. I would just read about ancient Egypt. I wrote my own story and drew my own pictures to go with it in maybe the second or third grade about ancient Egypt, and that was nonfiction.
And as a historian, I can say that in ancient Egypt, telepathic dragons and horses, they were all real. Then, so.
Yes, the dragons were also telepathic, if I didn't specify that. They really were.
Autumn, what about you? How did you get hooked on reading?
Oh, goodness. My grandmother was a huge reader, so I can't remember ever not reading. My mom was also an elementary school teacher and had a classroom full of books. So after class, I would always go to her room, sit in the beanbag, and, you know, pull out one of the books. And one that I do remember not being able to put down was, this was a very academic book, "Stand back," said the elephant. "I'm going to sneeze."
That's very practical.
Yes, that's it is, right? You don't want to be anywhere near an elephant when he's going to sneeze, as all the animals knew. And it was very dramatic and, you know, just silly and fun to, you know, come from math class and read the silly story about animals. The actual first academic book or great book that I remember reading was Great Expectations. Mm. And I was a child. And I read it curled up in my room in the corner, and I could not tell you anything that happened in that book right now. I don't know why I couldn't put it down, but I read it in 2 days.
And I think readers just get that. And in fact, you know, a small aside, I knew when I started dating my wife that this was going to be serious when very early in our relationship, we went to a used bookstore. And I was on the floor sitting at stacks like you've described in your mom's classroom. And I looked over to thought, oh, my gosh, it's been like 15 minutes. You know, what did she do? And she was doing the exact same thing two rows over. So I knew this whole thing was going to work. How do you impress your passion for reading on students or others who might not necessarily see why reading is so transformational?
Well, I think that's actually the challenge that we're facing today. All of us told a story that basically turned on self-motivation. In some cases, our parents helped us out, and I know that I've done dramatic reading for my children. But some of this has to come from inside of us, and schools face a challenge a lot of the time. You can avoid doing what happened to Abby and making people read books that you think are good for them, except how else are people going to be educated? Right. And then putting a passion into someone, all I think you can really do is infect them. I don't think you can teach it. Some of this is internally motivated.
What about the rest of y'all? How do you get people as excited about reading as you are?
I think demonstrating that excitement ourselves, that's how I got interested in being an English professor. I saw one of my own professors so passionate about a poem that I just was not getting, and I could not figure out why she was so emotional about this. And, you know, that kind of led me to looking more into it, and I think that's important.
I do think that's what I meant by infection.
Yeah, sure.
Charles?
Well, as you know, I was not born in a reading culture. I was born in a rural environment where reading was not the thing. Storytelling, as I said earlier, my grandmother told me stories, my father told me stories, my mom told me stories. So in school is where I began reading. And that's why I remember vividly how I was impressed or how I responded to my first book, my first grade book. How I encourage students and others to see reading as a transformational activity, I always like to talk about the story of Frederick Douglass. I hearken back to Frederick Douglass, who was born a slave, taught himself to read, and was able to transform his life from being a slave to becoming a journalist, an abolitionist, a statesman, and of course, an enlightened witness. So I tell students that through reading, they can construct for themselves a sense of agency for whatever they want to do.
Yeah, it really inspires confidence to help people sort of break out of their shell and trust some of their ideas as well. All right, so what's in a great book? What are the ingredients? What transforms a book from interesting reading to one of the classics?
I was thinking about this, and I think the first answer all of us have is sort of what Melissa was talking about with that childhood experience, which is that you relate to it in some ways. But I also think that that's actually entirely wrong. I think what makes a great book great is that it forces us into a viewpoint that we wouldn't have seen otherwise, right? I mean, one of the things I tell my students is that if it was really just about plot or theme, we could have stopped creating art 2,500 years ago, because we've done all those things already, right? I mean, what a great artist does is they somehow make us see the world or see some viewpoint in a way that we haven't before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that really is part of what makes a great book great or any piece of art great. You know, I think I would probably hate Keats as a person because he seems really annoying and he's constantly telling me that how as an artist he's so much better than me and that he can show me what I don't see. But then there are stanzas where I'm like, oh my gosh, I had never seen the world that way, and you somehow had the power to let me see it through your eyes for a second. And so it's the particularity, I think, rather than the universality, though I think our impulse is then to somehow universalize that or connect to that. But it's really that transformative experience of somehow entering somebody else's vision.
Wow. Drop the mic and walk off. Well done. Yeah.
I had to compete with Charles.
It is also worth noting that almost any book can be great. You have to ask yourself, great for what? And great in what time, in what context? So we often think of classics as books that have either stood the test of time because they speak to many generations or many different societies. And in that case, I don't know if my dragon and telepathic horse books are going to stand that test of time. But they probably did a lot to help adolescent girls of the 70s and 80s. And that was achieving something. So greatness is definitely contextual. You might then talk about something like Uncle Tom's Cabin or Huck Finn, which is, well, to go back to Charles's first experience, both Twain and Stowe are, you know, they accomplish something with their books. I'm sure as a historian, Jeff, you don't go along with the idea that Harriet Beecher Stowe created the Civil War, but even having somebody tell you that you did is quite a lot. It's an index of the book's impact in the world. And we do still read it, but when we read it today, it's very differently. Both of the two books, Huck Finn and Uncle Tom's Cabin, are frequently attacked and taken off of reading lists because the way the characters speak is not how we would speak today. And so I think it's important to have books that still create a stir as well, doing the work to understand why things then are not what they are now is one of the more fundamental purposes, and I guess that is exactly what Abby said, which is to put you into a different point of view, but that you have to do some work. And I think that goes against the idea of being immersed. Mm. When you're immersed, you just are carried along and it does what it does to you. When you are reading critically, you're to some extent resisting that impulse, but both things can be great.
Yeah, I think you know you're really reading something really interesting to you and really that may stand the test of time if you can't wait to make sure that someone else is reading it so you can talk about it and what you think it means and how you do relate or don't relate to certain things.
We'll return to our panel in 30 brief minutes in just a moment. UNCP and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about the college's 16 departments, college highlights, and news, as well as to find past episodes of 30 Brave Minutes and our digital journal Bravery, explore our website. You can also support our academic programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. Remember, wherever you go and whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
So how should we read a book? Is there any right or wrong way? Do we just jump in and start swimming?
I think Abby and I have already answered, no, there is no right or wrong way.
But you should probably have a telepathic dragon.
There you go. When your students are struggling to find key elements of the work that you really want them to, how do you go back and say, well, how did you miss this? Were you reading for just plot? Were you missing character changes? How do you help them to see those kinds of things that sometimes get overlooked in a book?
Well, if you are reading something because you have to be able to write a paper about it or take a test on it, I have a study guide, I'm sure we all do, how to read for that purpose. And I actually tell students to do both. Read it the first time without taking notes. Let yourself be immersed. the second time go back and read it analytically. Of course, that means doubling your reading.
Yeah, no, actually, I think to go back to your last question, the answer is how to read something is to read it more than once, right? And that is already hard to do. But so one thing I tell my students, and I would tell anyone who's sort of struggling to get into a great book, you know, go to the Cliff Notes, go to Schmoop. You don't have to spend all that time struggling to follow the plot and to know who the characters are, because that's, again, not where really the pleasure and value of great literature is. So that's fine. That's not cheating, because that's not actually why you're reading, right? And so give yourself some help. If it helps to, you know, watch the movie first and then read the book afterwards, so that you can have that immersive, pleasurable rereading experience, even if you find ways to skip the first read, basically.
Let's think about what you're reading now, and do you read things only work-related or only in your field? How do you mix reading something just because and something that you might have to stay current in your field?
This is where I envy my kids the most, because they can still just read stuff because they want to, and my time is so much more limited. But yes, I do still read because I want to, but typically it's not Victorian literature. I know you're very sad to hear that. If I'm reading something, I'm going back to that same fantasy and sci-fi genre that gave me the hit in the first place.
What about you, Charles? What are you reading right now?
I'm reading The Life of Napoleon and Josephine, his letters to Josephine.
Doesn't end well.
I love biographies. And as we said, as great literature has this sense of universality, you know, that utility that is universal. And I see in great persons, those archetypes that connect us all, whether it's by love or about struggle. And going back to how we encourage our students to read, I encourage them to see reading as a form of conversation, for them to immerse themselves in the reading act, strike a conversation with the author, because the author is seeking to converse with you, to interact with you.
It's an interactive exercise, isn't it? You know, you're responding in your own mind. You're responding either in your own head or out loud to the author. You're talking to other people about what they think. You're examining other viewpoints of it. It really is an interactive experience. What are you reading now, Autumn?
Well, this one's interesting. I just got married, so on my honeymoon, I was in the airport trying to find a book, and, you know, that's a little difficult based on some of the selections. Not a lot of great books in those stores, but I came across one by Roxane Gay called Difficult Women. So I thought this would be perfect for my honeymoon, and it's just a series of short stories about not necessarily difficult women, but the difficulties that women go through. So it was an interesting read. But I do like to read things in my field, read things for fun. And sometimes reading things in your field can be fun when you kind of take yourself out of the English professor position and just kind of let yourself get lost in that for just a second.
Okay, so time to weigh in. Favorite books or favorite authors would probably work as well. Who would you put in your top three of either books or authors?
I'll go ahead. Since Charles mentioned Frederick Douglass, he's actually on my list. I think every American should read Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass for the reasons that Charles talked about. The education and the emphasis on how important that is. And it's an amazing story, right? Yes. It's just incredible. Absolutely. I would also add The New Jim Crow, which was just unbanned from North Carolina prisons last week. Mm-hmm. An amazing book that really makes you think about things you wouldn't normally think about. And I'll leave it at that, since that sounds
incarceration
mysterious.
Rates and pornography.
Amazing. And my favorite author from my period is George Lepard.
I mean, just add to what you to that theme, Conrad's The Heart of Darkness, right. Is a book that every American should read, because it's an exploration, you know, into the heart of man, every woman. You know, how we as humans harbor virtue and also the capacity for evil. So it's good to be aware. It's a sort of a conscious psychological exploration of humanity's potential.
I had a class in high school called World Literature, and all we did was read and then talk about it, which is like the greatest class for me, you know, to think about. And I can't remember what we were reading, whether it was Hermann Hesse or somebody, you know, a little out there for a high school kid. And I remember telling my teacher, I'm not sure what the theme is here. I'm not sure what he's trying to accomplish. And she said to me, she says, when in doubt, because you'll be reading the rest of your life, answer, the theme is man's inhumanity to man. How about you, Melissa and Abby? What would you put?
Well, on that tip of man's inhumanity to man, I mean, I think, and this is not in my field, but the one book, if you had to choose one novel, it would be Toni Morrison's Beloved. Mm-hmm. I think it is just, as a novel, it is one of the most perfectly structured pieces of work I've read. It talks about man's inhumanity to man, and particularly about what it means to be an American, whether that's a Black American or a white American, and dealing with the legacy of slavery. But it does it in just the most beautiful and stunning way. Mm-hmm. So I try to fit into as many classes I teach as possible. To make a plug for Victorinus, I think, you know, the works of Dickens, just because everything, you know, through those you have just chances to cry massively, to laugh, to see characters that you just can still imagine. There's a couple of Dickens novels I haven't read yet that I'm saving deliberately for retirement to just have that pleasure ahead of me.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
But Chuzzlewit, I'm still holding on to. I don't know how excited I'm going to be. And then, you know, I'm going to make a plug for Jane Austen and just I can't tell you how many times I've read all of her books over and over and just the pure pleasure of that. And again, I think with a theme, just her power with words and the way that she moves you to laughter and lets you see the world in new ways.
Austen is a great example of one of those authors who gets named, and many people who love her teach her frequently. And I am the same. I would have named Dickens and Austen if Abby hadn't taken that off of me. But I'm going to say, I'm not going to name books. What I'm going to do is say that people need to read at least one thing that they don't think that they are going to relate to, that they will learn from and get something out of in a utilitarian way, maybe not utilitarian, but a values way. I mean, that's what most of our answers have been. But they also should find the thing that they can be immersed in and that can speak to them and that can simply help them process their own life, even if it's got to involve telepathic dragons, because I can't tell you what that will be. That will be different for every person. And I guess on a positive note, although I have mixed feelings about this, one thing that K-12 schools in America are trying to do is incentivize reading in kids with a program called Accelerated Reader, where they read books and then take quizzes on the computer, get points towards rewards usually at school. And that can turn books into just an assembly line. But on the upside of that, AR makes a point of coming up with a quiz for any book you can think of. So my telepathic dragons are in there. I looked it up.
Is it a family tradition now?
No, not yet, actually. I haven't gotten the boys interested in Anne McCaffrey or Mercedes Lackey yet. Maybe someday. But they don't try to pick and choose. They do realize that in books about ancient Egypt there's nonfiction on there. There's books about dinosaurs. And I think maybe just doing it more makes it easier to do.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there's books that you read for different reasons, and a lot of you have said that, and to capture a different side of who you are, a biography maybe to relate to someone. Before I'm getting ready to write a journal article or something, I'll always read two or three pieces of fiction from the period of time in Southern history that I'm writing about to just sort of more fully situate myself in one sense of the lives of the ordinary people that I tend to write about. And that always seems to be inspiring to me in some ways. All right, final question, the proverbial desert island question. What's the one book that you would need to have on you that's worth reading and rereading dozens of times while you're waiting to be rescued at sea?
See, I'm crazy, so I've already planned this in my head, and I had a compendium of all the works of Jane Austen, so I'm cheating, but that's what I'm taking.
Charles?
I am taking the complete works of Lawrence Stern. In Stern, you have everything. You know, you see Stern as a minister, you see Stern as a statesman, you see him as a writer, and he's an entertainer. You know, he called himself Yorick, you know, the famous Shakespeare jester. So I'm taking Laurence Stern's complete works.
Autumn?
I hate to piggyback, but yeah, Pride and Prejudice is a good one. It's one that I've read multiple times before and would be happy to read multiple times in the future.
Melissa?
I'm not going to play your little game.
dragons.
I truly can't choose, and although I don't use electronic readers, I don't like them. I like reading on paper still. I would say that is one advantage of the modern world, is that it is possible to carry around so many books that you don't have to make that choice anymore.
Yeah, wonderful way to end. And I think all of us would say if we had to be on a desert island, we have to have something to read, whether it's the dream book or not. Well, thanks to all of you for helping to make this a really fun discussion. And for all of you listening, thanks again. Pick up a good book and take a listen to all of what your heart is telling you about what you're reading. Thanks.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.
Good job, everybody.